Today's Taisho is case 58 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. P.N. Lu case 58 is entitled Joshu's No Justification. Case 58, Joshu Jiaozhou's No Justification. Main subject, a monk said to Joshu, "You so often quote the words, 'The great way is not difficult. It only abhors choice and attachment.' Isn't that your point of attachment?" Joshu said, "A man asked me the same question once before, and 5 years later, I still have found no justification for it." Secho's verse, "King elephants yawn. King lions roar. Plain words stop men's mouths. North, south, east, and west, the crow swoops, the hare bounds." So those of you who are rather new, may not know the story of Jiaozhou. Japanese people say Joshu. And when Jiaozhou was like 18 years old, he went to a sesshin and a Changchi, and he basically had an insight into fundamental reality. And it was what we call a Kensho experience, an opening, an insight or an opening. It's like normally we see things in a confused way, and suddenly we see things as they are, at least some. We have a glimpse of the way things are. That's called Kensho, or opening. He had a Kensho, and basically he said, it ruined everything, basically, is how he put it. And that was a poetic way of saying it ruined, it overturned all my assumptions, right? And he decided, after it overturned all his assumptions, to become a Chan monk. And he went looking for a teacher, and he found Nan Chuan. And they became a student and teacher for like 40 years. Until Nan Chuan died, Nan Sen died. Jiaozhou is really one of the most remarkable Zen teachers of the Tang Dynasty. Really, probably there are more Joshu stories in the Heikigan Roku, in the P.N. Lu, than stories about any other teacher except, I think, Umon, Yunmen, Cloud Gate. And that's because in some ways Joshu and Yunmen were really like towering figures of Zen. And so their teachings or their koans are so valuable and that they've been included in all these anthologies. Their insight into helping students wake up was so remarkable. After Jiaozhou went to study with Nan Chuan died after 40 years, and everybody thought Jiaozhou was going to take over Nan Chuan's temple. But that's not what happened. Jiaozhou went out on the road, and in China at this time, in the Tang Dynasty, all over China, there were public temples. I've mentioned this before, but In the United States, we have a system of free public education. And that means that any town will have an elementary school, an intermediate school, and a high school. And the quality of the education may not be good or it may be excellent, but every town has a school system. And in the Tang Dynasty, people thought so highly of Fong Zhao, of Buddhism, that they created a system of public temples. And this was true until right up until the Cultural Revolution in China. And a monk or a nun could present herself or himself at a public temple. And you had to carry papers, like a license, like a monk's license, actually. And you presented your license to the Karmadhana. And the Karmadhana assigned you a room and said, okay, this is your room. You know, lunch is at 12:30. And we start session next week. So this was the world of Buddhism in the Tang Dynasty. And Zhou Xu, went out on the road and went all over China, going to these different temples and meeting the teachers there. And some of the stories of Zhou Xu involve his encounters with teachers. So, you know, he met Wang Bo, for example. He met Obaku. So there's some encounters. Nansen also knew Obaku. So all these people were contemporaries. So Zhou Xu went around China, and he would go to a temple, and he would present his papers, and he'd be assigned a room, but he had a reputation as being a great Zen master. And sometimes he would engage with the teacher. And I mentioned the other day that, you know, Zen teachers try to help everybody experience reality more fully by pulling the rug out from under them. You know, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. That's a koan. Another koan is all things return to the one. But to what does the one return? See? So, you know, if somebody asks you, what's Buddhism about? And you say, oneness. See, you think, well, that covers everything. Oneness. You know, that pretty much does it. What's Buddhism about? Oneness. All is one. But, you know, actually, that doesn't cover everything. That doesn't cover everything. If you cling to oneness, there will be things you have to ignore or things you have to repress or escape from. Sometimes oneness is not where you have to go in life, right? Maybe your life feels very whole, and then somebody says, a friend of mine, her life, she was a professor. She was a very accomplished person, and then her sister died. And my friend, the professor, had to take over her sister's kids because she had to take care of her sister's children. And she was like not a motherly kind, right? But, you know, she took it very seriously. She had to take over these orphaned children and care for them, right? And she could say, I'm sorry, but I like my life. It's oneness. The oneness of my life is perfect, right? But now she has to introduce imperfection into her life. She has to introduce frustration, right? She has to introduce an angry teenager into her life, right? So all of these things make her life less than unified, right? And that actually is, you know, actually, of course, you know where this story is going. It transformed her, right, to be in this terrible situation of having a sister who died and then having to take care of her children, her two kids. So, you know, sometimes oneness is not what we need, right? And if we cling to oneness, we become smaller. We become defensive, or we're not open to experience. So the Zen idea is that Zen masters try to show you what you aren't seeing, okay? And Joshu would meet with these Zen masters, and they would try to pull the rug out from each other, under each other, right? And Joshu might say something to the master. And there are actually many occasions where these are recorded, not in the Mumonkan and in the Pi and Lu, but in other collections, like Nansen and Wang Bo met each other. And you can see them communicating in ways that are designed to keep opening up their experience. So anyway, sometimes Joshu would meet masters, and they would engage in this kind of dialogue. In Japanese, it's called a mando, M-O-N-D-O. And that's where the two teachers are trying to show each other something new. Sometimes a student would sort of take aim at Joshu to sort of say, like, you're the great Joshu, eh? Well, I don't think you're so great. So this is one of these koans, right? So you're supposed to be enlightened, eh? Well, let's see about that, right? So anyway, Joshu, by the way, loved the Xin Xin Ming, right? That was one of his favorite Buddhist texts. So every day we recite in the morning Sengzan's Xin Xin Ming. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When this is translated here as when love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. It could be when attachment and revulsion are both absent. That's another way to translate that. So anyway, Joshu is visiting this temple, and a monk said to Joshu, in other words, a monk is, as we say in English, gunning for Joshu. He's trying to challenge Joshu. You so often quote Sengzan's Xin Xin Ming, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Isn't that a preference? Isn't your liking that a preference? And Joshu said, a man asked me the same question once before, and 5 years later, I still have no justification for it. I still have no justification for it. So this is called no justification. So it took me a while to get to the koan, but I got there. You know, somebody said to me the other day, when I was a kid, I used to be spacey. I used to space out a lot. And actually, I myself used to space out a lot too. And my teacher, Webb Roshi, used to space out a lot. When I was a kid, I was the kind of kid who would, my mother would put my coat on and my mittens, and she'd send me to school, and I'd come home with my book bag, and she'd say, where's your coat? Where's your mittens? And I had no idea. It's like, coat? Mittens? Right? I don't know. Who knows? You know, who knows? And she said, well, you're going back. We're driving to the school, and you're going to get your coat and your mittens, right? And we'd go. And then I would look, you know, there, it's not in my classroom. I'd go out in the playground, and I left it in the sandbox or something, right? You know, and she, you know. But I was that kind of a kid. I would, you know, go to class, and I would have left my book at home, right? That was classic. Or literally, I was the kind of kid who homework. Oh my God, I forgot. You know, I forgot we had homework. You know, I would get to school, and suddenly I'd realize, oh, I forgot that homework. I knew there was something I didn't want to think about. When I was a kid too, people would correct me. You know, they could see I was spacing out, and they'd say, hey, you know, look at me. Where are you? You know, and I was spaced out. You know, it's possible the person who told me this had similar experiences, right? And this is sometimes called dissociative behavior. And it can become like a disorder, where you're just not present, right? But actually, you know, spacing out is not so bad, right? Not so bad. When I was spacing out, usually it was because in my home there was a lot of conflict, or I was bored, and it was just uncomfortable to be present with what was going on. And you know, if you space out too much, it does create problems. You can, you know, you can fail to do your homework. You can lose your coat. If you develop a dissociative disorder, you know, you can really be inattentive for long stretches of time. So I'm not recommending that. But I think something can be said for spacing out. You know, when people space out as little kids, what they're really saying is, I don't want to be here. And sometimes saying, I don't want to be here, is actually a healthy response. You know, and this sounds very un-Zen, right? Because in Zen we talk about all the time, be present, you know, be mindful. But, you know, actually, there's a certain kind of mindfulness which isn't helpful. You know, you need to be able to step outside of the official, approved, collective reality. Because it's not real, I would like to say. You know, in the sutras, there's this phrase that can be translated as, it says, ordinary people have upside-down views. That's how, sometimes it's translated as inverted views. But another way to translate it is upside-down views. So, you know, the ordinary way of living, or ordinary reality, is characterized by upside-down views. And when you're a little kid and you space out, in a way, you're kind of saying, you know, I'm voting with my feet. I'm leaving this upside-down world. And, you know, I don't think that's so bad. I actually think it's actually a sign of, believe it or not, I think it's kind of a sign of strength. Let me just say that the willingness to not be present in an upside down world, when you see that in little kids, you know, it's often seen as a defect, but I think it's a sign of it's a sign of intelligence and a sign of strength, really. You know, I just in defense of people who are sometimes spaced out, you know, let me say that there's a very famous story about Galileo. You know, I know this story because when I read it, I thought, oh, you know, this justifies my forgetting my coat. But Galileo is supposed to have he was walking with his horse, and he went up a hill, and when he came down, he no longer had the horse. And he couldn't remember what he did with his horse. And a friend of my wife's is the chief engineer he's retired now, at Princeton. And he said one of the calls they would get at Princeton all the time, that the people in the security branch, they would get calls from professors in the physics department who would call and say, my car's been stolen. But it hadn't been stolen. They had just forgotten where they parked it. So, you know, it's definitely true that a Zen person is attentive, right? A Zen person should be attentive. So, you know, when you come into the Zendo, you should put your sandals neatly down against the wall. You shouldn't just toss them down. You should clean your bowls mindfully, and so on and so on. So yes, yes. But, you know, there's a bigger issue here. And that is, you know, in a world that's not sane, that's not healthy, you know, when a little kid says, I don't want to be here, and just sort of mentally withdraws, that's not necessarily a bad thing. it's a sign, as I say, it's a sign of strength and intelligence, right? To say that this is not how things should be, and it's not where I need to be. And so if you were shamed or othered for being a space cadet when you were a kid, you know, maybe that's why you're here now. You know, maybe that's why you were here now. I think that's, you know, I definitely grew up in environments that were not enlightened environments. And, you know, part of my checking out was just spacing out in general, being spacey and not present. But it also led me to read a lot of books, which was a good thing. And books also are a way of checking out, right? It's like, I don't think I want to spend my day on the military base today playing football. I think I'll go read a book, right? And that was really eye-opening for me. And you know, reading a book is a way of protesting. You know, it's saying, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life doing this, you know, living this way. I'm going to go read in my room, and I'm going to realize that there's something more to life than this stuff. And I think little space cadets are also kind of saying that. They're saying, you know, this is not real. And maybe the child doesn't say, this is not real, this is a fabrication, this is a collective illusion. But the child kind of knows it. Right? You know, child sort of senses, this is not where I want to be. This is not a good place. It's not a nurturing home. It's not a, you know, I used to go to school, and every day I would go to school, you know, there were bullies between my apartment complex in Baltimore and the school, you know. So it's no wonder I was spacey, right? It's like, you know, what a world, right? So, you know, we live in a society that has bad values, if I may say so, generally speaking. And, you know, every day you open the newspaper and you read about, the environment situation. I was reading something the other day where it said that, you know, basically we produce so many clothes that we don't know what to do with them. Our system, the global clothing production system, produces so many clothes that we can't buy them all, you know. There are people in the world who are so poor, they have like a shirt and a pair of pants. That's definitely true. And there are people who don't even have a pair of pants, actually, you know. If you know the musician Little Richard, he was a blues musician and quite a dynamic performer, if you know him. But he grew up as an African-American in the South in a very poor, his parents were, I think, sharecroppers. The brothers had like one good pair of pants and they would trade it off, right? So, you know, basically when they had to go to someplace that required a good pair of pants, they would get the pair of pants out of the closet. So, you know, I realized that all over the world there's people like that. But on the other hand, you know, there's people who have so many clothes, they have to build houses with bigger and bigger closets, right? The article was saying that people have so many clothes they don't even wear them. They stockpile clothes. And then when they give them away, they said the agencies that handle used clothes, like Goodwill, can't handle all the clothes. And so ultimately, clothes go to the landfill. And believe it or not, this article said clothes are the number one of the major polluters now is clothing. When it decays, it releases methane. So, you know, certainly we need to correct this problem by studying the situation. And we need to have experts come in and maybe redesign the production system. But, you know, that will never happen as long as people crave material things, right? As long as people are thinking, you know, I must get this, or they, you know, I myself, you know, get, I'm on many companies' mailing lists, and, you know, you will get a catalog from Land's End, and it's summer, and you open the catalog, and you look inside, and it's full of these clothes that are beautiful colors, and I have a strong desire to experience summer by buying the shirt, right? You know, they have these shirts that are cool looking, they look cool on the guys in the catalog anyway. And they have nice designs, you know, sort of sporty and youthful. Youthful is a big thing for me these days. So you know, and they look summer. It looks like the essence of summer. So if I buy the shirt, I can buy summer. I can be in summer, thanks to Land's End. You know, and I have to check myself because I go upstairs and I've got like a lot of shirts. You know, I've got summer shirts. But it's part of a cultural system, right? This is how shopping does feel liberating, right? I know so many people who, when they're stressed, they go shopping, and they're it makes sense, you know. Shopping is exploratory. There's pretty things there, beautiful things. It's basically an adventure, and you know, I have friends of mine who say that we're hardwired to be hunters and gatherers, right? To look for things and you know, find things, you know, like. But the system is really unhealthy because people don't know how to be happy with less. And there, if you everywhere you turn, you know, there's a kind of a general, I would say, a society out of balance, or a society that's not mentally healthy. And people who feel compelled to use material things to define themselves or their to improve their self-image, you know, those are all very human things. Every human being does that. Even the Dalai Lama does that to some degree. But it's very important for people to develop other sources of other ways of being grounded, other ways of feeling whole, and so on. So I think our society is not a healthy society in many, many ways, and it's not a compassionate society. And so, you know, that little kid who's spacing out is kind of really like a sign of hope, I think. And I think lots of people would like to have a different society, but they don't know how. And I believe, I mean, the one of the reasons I have been doing Zen for 40 years, besides it's exciting, and is I think it teaches people how to be alive in a different way. You know, sooner or later, if people do Zen, they realize that they are much freer than they thought. You know, so, basically, Joshu is really trying to tell this monk, you know, you're free in a way you don't understand, you know. The monk is trying to, embarrass Joshu because he thinks of Joshu as a high-status person. So Joshu is a high-status person who is who has a reputation. Lots of people admire him. And, you know, probably the monk wants to be like that. He wants to be a high-status person that everybody will look up to. So right now, you know, when Joshu goes to the monastery, all the monks go, "Joshu, Joshu?" It would be like the Dalai Lama came to, in the 80s, the Dalai Lama came to our Zen center in Seattle because Webb had a lot of connections with the Tibetan. And it was like, the Dalai Lama coming to our Zen center? Well, it's like that with Joshu, right? You know, Joshu here? So, you know, maybe this monk sees Joshu and is consumed with envy, fear, feels threatened, you know, and both would like to be Joshu and is, you know, would like to be Joshu, would like to have that kind of prestige and that kind of respect, that kind of reverence, right? And so he's trying to knock Joshu down. It's like, if I knock Joshu down, maybe I can take his place, you know. And this is so human. It's so human, you know, for people to do this. You know, in this case, the monk is craving the approval of others and thinks the way to get it is to knock down Joshu. Maybe you'll think more of me if you think less of Joshu. And this is very common. You know, if you go on the internet, you know, the whole phenomenon of trolls, right, you know. Maybe if I can get you to think badly of somebody, you'll think better of me, right? That's sort of the behavior here. And Joshu tries to make this monk understand, look, you're free. You don't need to justify your life. You don't need to justify your life. You're radically free, right? You know, when somebody gives you a koan, you know, and you're lost and at sea, you know, every person will answer that koan in a different way. There will be similarities, but every person brings to the koan something, you know, that even that person doesn't know in advance, right? And, you know, there's an openness to koan practice. You know, you don't know where it's taking you. And, you know, every time you get stuck in a koan and you're wandering around, actually you're experiencing a kind of freedom that most people don't have. And Joshi's trying to tell this monk, look, you don't need to justify your existence. Every time we are justifying our existence, that's usually an unhealthy response to our life, right? It's usually, if you think about it, every time you find yourself trying to justify yourself, that means you feel that you're not basically worthy of your existence, and you're trying to answer somebody in your life, right, who disapproved of you, you know. And that keeps you a prisoner all your life, right? That keeps you a prisoner. You know, and so Joshua is saying, I don't need a justification. You know, I'm following my true nature. I'm following my true nature. Just to speak, when I got interested in Zen, my father was very disapproving of my being involved in Zen. You know, there was a person who wanted to come to Sesshin this time, and his parents disapproved so much of Zen, of Buddhism actually, that they made a big issue out of it, and he didn't come to Sesshin. They didn't approve of his coming to Sesshin because it's Buddhism. And I'm sorry he didn't come to Sesshin. He definitely should have come, right? If only because his parents disapproved of it, actually. No, really. Just to be, you know, you're an adult, right? You're a 30-some-year-old person. It's time you stopped listening to your parents all the time, right? You know, that's common. You know, people don't always develop that kind of independence and that kind, you know, he's justifying himself. He feels he has to justify himself. His parents fed him, maybe. They took care of him. They loved him. So he's going to live their life, basically, unless something happens. And my father disapproved of me doing this. He let me know that this was he actually gave me something. It was a he gave me something, some essay or something about you know, the foolishness of these young hippies turning to the East, right? You know? There was that article somewhere. It was like the misguided youth, you know, turning to the East, you know. And my when I was in graduate school, my one of my graduate director, I was meeting with him one day, and I had to go sit to the Zen sit, and I said, "Listen, I'm going to have to leave. I have to go over to I have to get to Central Seattle." And he said, "Oh, where are you going?" And I thought for a minute, you know, my spider sense. Like Spider-Man has a spider sense. My intuition said, "Don't tell him," you know. And I said, "Oh, I actually am a Zen student. I'm a member of the Seattle Zen Center." And he's, "What?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I go to sit, you know, three times a week." And he's, it was like, "You are wasting your life, you know, this. What a waste. You should be in the library. You should be publishing your articles, you know." And, you know, Sesshin, it was just like, we couldn't even speak of it. I don't even want to speak of it. You know? So, you know, and I've had other experiences like that also, you know. This really happened. There is a guy in my field who was the president of the organization that I belonged to at one time. He served a four-year term. And for many years, I was less active in my field. And I stopped going to conferences in my field for a number of years because I was doing sesshin that conflicted with the conference. And this guy is Charles, is his name, and he's a lovely man, but he's a lot like my graduate director. And apparently, somebody told him, "Well, you know, Kurt Spellmeyer, actually, he's a Zen teacher. You know, he's been practicing Zen." And he said he's not at the conference. He said he's something like, "The next thing you'll tell me is that he's joined the circus." You know. Really, he actually said that. The next thing I'll know, he's run off with the Barnum and Bailey circuit. But really, it was like incredulous and total, like, what? You know? "I am so glad that I ran off with the circuit. You know? I am so happy that I did that. Thank God I didn't listen to my father, you know? And I loved my father, but thank God I didn't listen to him because he was so wrong, right?" And so Joshua is trying to tell this monk, "Don't live your life that way. Don't live your life that way. You know, trust your true nature. Trust your true nature. Listen to that voice." You know, people come to sit sometimes, and I'll say, you know, how's the sit? And they say, "Oh, wonderful." And they'll come back, and I'll say, "How's your sit?" "Oh, very good." And I'll say, you know, please trust that part of yourself. But a lot of times they don't. They don't trust it. They don't trust. They don't trust freedom, and they don't trust their own happiness. They just don't. You know, and because it doesn't make sense to them, right? You know, something like coming to sesshin just doesn't make sense. You know, I don't make any money coming to sesshin, right? I actually have to pay money to come to sesshin. You know, I could be doing something that made me some money. I could be doing something that gave me an item on my CV, right? On my resume, you know. If I took a class, I could put that on my resume. If I practice Zen for, you know, I do three sesshin a year, I can't put that on my resume, right? In fact, you might not want it on your resume. Because then you've joined the circus. So Joshu is trying to tell this monk something really important. Yes, respect your parents, love your parents, but your life is your life. Right? Your life is your life. And, you know, if you're a graduate student, you know, you can respect your graduate director, but he, you know, you don't have to live his life, right? And we are radically free. You know, the culture we live in is upside down culture. Its values are terrible, often. It's not compassionate. It's not intelligent. It's destructive. And it could go on and on. So, you know, even though we know all of that intellectually, it's very difficult to step outside of that and say, I'm going to live a different kind of life. I'm going to listen to my true nature. You know, and I'm, you know, and for me, that has meant I am going to practice the great way. I am going to practice Zen. You know, and so, you know, when I tell people, they say, you know, I say, well, I can't come to that event. On January the 14th, I'm afraid I won't be able to attend because I will be at Sesshin, right? And that's, or I'll tell people, if you want me to come to dinner, it can't be Monday, Wednesday, or Friday, right? And you don't have to make that decision. You don't have to do that. But that's how I've chosen to live my life, because I love my life. I love following the Zen path. And, you know, everybody has to make this decision for themselves, but don't, you know, Joshu's warning the monk, don't let that mentality of justifying, of looking for justification, govern your life. You know, and you know, one of the first things Zen students learn is that the teacher's not going to give them the answer, right? So, you know, when the teacher gives you the koan, you know, if it would be absurd to say to the Zen teacher, well, what answer do you want me to give, right? But my students say that to me all the time. I'll say, well, so what do you think? You know, what does this author say? And they'll say, well, basically, they say, what do you want me to say to get an A? Right? Well, what do you want me to say to get an A? And I'll say what you want to say. That's likely to get you the A, you know. But, you know, in school, people are told to, you know, basically say the thing you're expected to say. Anyway, Joshu is doing this monk a big service, because he has discovered, you know, Mu Xin is a door to freedom. When we sit in emptiness, we're deconditioning our minds and we're beginning to explore reality from a new perspective. And you know, the more you go into the, you know, Buddhism makes many interesting claims about reality, some of which have been even confirmed, like, by science, right? So, you know, physicists say time doesn't really exist. And in deep samadhi, when you're in deep Mu Xin, there, you often have the impression that there's no time. There are many, many things that are confirmed by the sciences that are taught by Zen. And Zen people get there by, you know, stepping outside the ordinary way of thinking and asking questions about, you know, when you watch your breath, where does the breath take you? You know, what does it mean? What is the breath? What is awareness of the breath, right? And when you watch the breath, you know it from your biology class, the O2 goes in and the CO2 goes out. You have lungs, they're little, I think they're called alveoli in your lungs, right, that pull the oxygen into your bloodstream and so on. But that's a textbook understanding of the breath. You know, if you watch your breath, it takes you to a place where everything disappears. And that's interesting, right? How can that be? How can it be that when I listen to the sound of the wind, eventually, if I really pay attention to the sound itself disappears, or my mind goes totally blank? Why is that? That's very interesting. So, you know, Zen is not, nobody in Zen is going to hand you a book and say, here are the, this is the Zen view. It's all based upon stepping outside of the ordinary upside down world and cultivating samadhi, attention, and then undoing your assumptions about reality. And then trusting your immediate experience, trusting your immediate experience on the cushion. So, you know, watch the breath, and you watch the breath. As the breath goes in, the breath goes out, the breath goes in. I knew that. But something strange happens when you really watch your breath without any presuppositions. Your mind becomes blank. It goes empty. And if you sit in that blankness long enough, something else happens. You begin to feel energy. Where's that energy coming from? What's that all about? How can emptiness have energy? See, and once you get started on this road, you know, every time you turn around, it's a different world. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So today, you know, everybody was sitting. This, I would say that this is one of the best sashins, you know, we've had in a long time. Everybody's sitting so deeply. Everybody's practicing so wholeheartedly. And it's thrilling to see. And there's no justification for it. Absolutely not. You know, there's no reason to do this. There's no reason. But you're doing it because it makes you, I hope, more alive. More alive. And I've been doing this for 43 years, and every sit is interesting. It's every sit is new. So, you know, please keep up the good work. You know, we have some precious time left until we end the session at 6. Some of you are still working on your koans, and some of you are working on new koans. And I wish we had another 2 days, because I think some of you are in two koan sesshin territory, right? Well, I answered 2 koans at sesshin, you know. But we don't. But there's a sesshin in May, so please think about that. But everybody is doing a fantastic job. Thank you. Main subject. A monk said to Joshu, you so often quote the words, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Isn't that a preference? Joshu said, oh, come on, man. You know, you don't have to justify your existence. Just follow your true nature. Secho's verse, king elephants yawn, right? The elephant just walks the earth, right? King lions roar. He just roars. Plain words stop men's mouths. North, east, south, and west, the crow swoops, the hare bounds. None of them are trying to justify themselves, right? They're all manifesting their fundamental nature.